We're back with the Tech Policy Grind. I'm Daniela Guzman Peña, a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, the organization where the next generation of tech law and policy professionals convene to write, think, and talk about the web, technology, and disruptive innovation. This is the Tech Policy Grind, the Foundry's podcast where we chat about what's going on in the world of tech policy. Hi, everyone. It's Daniela from the Tech Policy Grind. Evan Enzer, our co-executive producer and editor, and I sat down together at the beginning of the year to think about how we would put together this season. And we decided that a bi-weekly episode would be a good cadence. But sometimes there are conversations that are just so timely and newsworthy that we can't keep them to ourselves. So you're hearing from us again this week. Last week, the Supreme Court heard arguments on two First Amendment cases challenging laws in Florida and Texas that seek to limit the ability of internet companies to moderate content on their platforms. Social media companies argue that the laws in Texas and Florida violate the constitutional right to free speech, and the court's decision could change the legal boundaries around speech on the internet. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to invite an expert on this topic to moderate a discussion. This week, we're passing on the host mic to Internet Law and Policy Foundry alum, Jess Myers. Jess Myers is senior counsel at Chamber of Progress. As a lawyer and technologist, she focuses on the intersection of law and the internet and is widely considered an expert on U.S. intermediary liability law and has written, spoken, and taught extensively about topics such as speech and Section 230, content moderation, intellectual property, and cybercrime. To join her in this discussion, Jess invited her colleague Vidushi Dial, the Director of Legal Analysis at Chamber of Progress, and Eric Goldman, Associate Dean for Research, Professor of Law, and Co-Director of the High Tech Law Institute, as well as the Co-Supervisor of the Privacy Law Certificate at Santa Clara University School of Law. So without further ado, here's Jess, Vidushi, and Eric.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Tech Policy Grind podcast. This is Jess Myers, Senior Counsel for Chamber of Progress, and I'll be today's host for the conversation on the recent U.S. Supreme Court cases, NetChoice v. Moody and Paxton v. NetChoice. Joining me now is Vidushi Dial and Professor Eric Goldman. Thank you both so much for being here. We'll go ahead and just dive right into the questions, and Vidushi, I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about the procedural posture here. What does it mean for the laws to be currently enjoined or stayed as it is in Texas? What questions are currently before the court, and what are the options before the court as well?
Well, first, I'm happy to be here and to dive right in. Shortly after these laws were signed in 2021, NetChoice and the CCIA sought a preliminary injunction and to halt the enforcement of these laws until the conclusion of litigation. Federal courts, both in Florida and Texas, enjoined these laws on First Amendment grounds, and in turn, Florida appealed to the 11th Circuit and Texas to the 5th Circuit. The 11th Circuit ended up striking down the part of the Florida law that would limit the power of social media platforms to moderate and curate content, but they ended up upholding the law's individualized explanation requirement. The 5th Circuit, on the other hand, upheld Texas's law in its entirety, but they granted NetChoice and the CCIA's request to stay the law until the Supreme Court gave cert. Given the circuit split over these closely related laws, the Supreme Court decided to take up both cases together. And the issues that were presented before them were, first, whether the law's content moderation restrictions complied with the First Amendment, and whether the law's individualized explanation requirements complied with the First Amendment. So most of the bench seemed to agree that these laws were poorly constructed, far too nebulous, and that the government can't just exercise control over social media moderation simply to platform anti-vaxxer or insurrectionist viewpoints, which is how these laws came about. But a large part of the arguments ended up turning on the broad scope of these laws and the fact that NetChoice and CCIA brought a facial challenge as opposed to an as-applied challenge. So the court can decide that these laws are on their face unconstitutional, or they can send the case back down to lower courts to decide what uncertainties are posed. Justice Coney Barrett floated the possibility that the court could write an opinion that explicitly stated many of the law's applications are unconstitutional before they send it back down to lower courts to do the work of identifying when the laws might stand and when they might fail.
Excellent. So we heard a lot from this court really dig into that facial versus as applied challenge discussion. Can you give our audience just a little bit more background on why does that matter? Why do we care about as applied versus a facial challenge?
Yeah, so there are several ways to challenge a law under the First Amendment. A facial challenge seeks to invalidate the law entirely because every application is unconstitutional, whereas an as-applied challenge seeks to invalidate a particular application of the law or block its enforcement against a specific person or in specific cases. So a plaintiff that brings a facial challenge not only has to show that the law is unconstitutional as applied to them, but also show that the law has no plainly legitimate sweep. That being said, that it doesn't have a significant number of constitutional applications. And this was something that a lot of the judges seemed to wrestle with. I will say the attorney for Net Choice did point out to the bench that just because there might be one scenario somewhere that could work, that would not be enough to save the laws. And they highlighted a recent decision, APF v. Bonta, where the Supreme Court actually confirmed that for a First Amendment facial challenge to succeed, a plaintiff just has to show that there are a substantial number of invalid applications in relative to the law's plainly legitimate sweep.
Super helpful. Thank you for laying the groundwork there, Vidushi. All right, Professor Goldman, I'm going to turn to you. So haven't we been here before? I mean, look, I was probably in diapers around when we were last at this discussion, but I'm sure you probably remember. Why are we here again? What changed since the court first took on the question of online speech in the late 1990s? And what's really at stake here?
The effort to regulate the internet is as old as the internet itself. And governments have tried a wide range of different approaches, including the 1990s. There were a series of efforts to establish content standards for the internet. Most prominently, the Communications Decency Act passed in 1996 tried to create a zone where sites were walling off certain types of content for minors. And the court struck that down, essentially saying that whatever the internet is, it deserves the highest level of protection available to publishers of content under the First Amendment. And since that ruling, that's been the law of the land here in the United States. There have been additional laws passed at the federal and state level trying to navigate around that with very little success. And what's happened since is that the people who are hoping to control conversation online keep trying, and they keep experimenting with new policy, quote, innovations. And so what we see is now the court has to go through the Sisyphean task of hearing cases that involve what seem to me to be exactly the same kind of thing we've been dealing with over a quarter century. So that's where we are today. The real question that I think is on the table, will the Supreme Court reach a different conclusion this time? And even if they reach the same conclusion, will they say something different than they said back in 1907 that opens up the door for more policy, quote, innovations?
So is this all to say that we're going to be back here in another 20 years? You know, what if the court upholds Reno v. ACLU? Do you think the states are going to keep trying?
Yeah, this is not a one and done legal battle. It's not like there's a definitive win that ends all efforts to censor the internet. The impulses to censor the internet are omnipresent, and they're part of the human condition. They're never going to stop. So we thought that we got the ruling we needed back in 1997, and here we are 25 years later asking questions about the basic law that I thought were already resolved. And so 25 years from now, we're going to be doing it all over again, assuming there's still an internet in place that needs to be regulated. And I think that's really the thing that listeners ought to be questioning. What are the changes to the internet that's going to be driven by regulation that's coming online today, even if it's not struck down as unconstitutional, even if the Supreme Court does say that the current proposals are unconstitutional? What are the changes that are going to be taking place that are going to change how we talk to each other online? it seems to me 25 years from now, we will not be talking to each other as freely and robustly as we are today. So there'll be less need for the censors to intervene.
All I'm really hearing is job security for us First Amendment attorneys and internet lawyers. So like a brutal law professor, I'm going to stick with you, Professor Goldman. I'm not letting you off the hook here. We heard a lot of discussion about common carriage. Now, I thought common carriage laws just were for trains and innkeepers and meat packers. What is the relevance of common carriage in this discussion, and what relevance does it have specifically to the internet?
So I look at common carriage as more like a category of regulatory approaches. It's not like there's a single thing that establishes this thing called a common carrier that becomes a bright line test for a package of well-defined regulations. And that's part of the reason why the censors really like things like common carriage, because it can be potentially stretched and adapted to apply to a circumstance where it really isn't meant to apply at all. The basic idea behind common carriage is that there's certain types of very socially important functions where we want the vendors in that function to be providing equal treatment to their customers. Now, that's not the normal approach to capitalism. Normally, it's market demand and supply dictates outcomes. But common carriage intervenes and says, we're not going to let the market pick completely. We're going to establish that customers have the right to be offered the service and that they will be treated equally in the process once they're a customer. There are similar doctrines, which the Supreme Court got all tripped up on, like public accommodations law, which limit the ability of businesses to discriminate on the basis of customer identity. And there's antitrust law, which is another thing where it might require businesses to engage with customers that they would otherwise choose not to engage with. But common carriage in particular is applied when the idea is we're moving something from point A to point B. That can be things like transportation or mail. And it can include certain types of communication where the communication service is moving the communication from point A to point B. Like mail is something like that. It is a form of communication. Telephony is another form of service that moves a service from point A to point B. Socially important, we decide that we're going to choose a common carrier, that telephone companies are not always allowed to pick their customers, and that they have to treat customers equally. So what does any of this have to do with the publication of content on the internet over social media? Nothing. And that's really the point, is that the analogy is supposed to be some kind of proxy for moving content in social media or something like that. But it really is gibberish. It cannot survive any critical scrutiny. And so the only reason why we even discuss common carriage is because that's what the censors are hoping will give them the in to achieve what the First Amendment clearly should otherwise prohibit them from having.
Now, we heard a discussion about common carriage also applying to email and direct messaging. I think it's probably clear, or at least it should be clear, that common carriage makes little to no sense for our traditional social media services. How did you feel about the line of discussion regarding email and direct message?
We think about email and direct messages like the postal mail. The analogy isn't completely ridiculous. The idea is that we want these services not to be reading the contents of the message. In fact, they're not legally allowed to do so, but simply moving them in a manner that's equal across all customers from point A to point B. And we can make that analogy. The problem is that email and direct messaging has really two disparate functions that get bundled under the same title. There's the movement of the message from sender to recipient, and then there's the interface that's presented to the sender and the recipient, and in particular the recipient, to help hierarchy or prioritize messages that are coming in. So for example, Gmail offers folders that make messages more or less prominent. And if they're a common carrier, they may not be allowed to do that. But in fact, users might very well value that kind of prioritization of their inbox. And so it's difficult to disaggregate the two, but really we might need to do so to distinguish the movement of the messages between sender and recipient to the interface that's made available to the recipient once it's received.
So to make sure I'm hearing you clearly here, does that mean that if email were common carriers, they have to treat spam the same way that they treat regular messages?
Well, so that's an example where we might conclude that when it moves from point A to point B, that the spam needs to be treated like all other messages. But when it reaches the recipient, it might be that it isn't treated equally because, in fact, the recipient wants the service to make distinctions between them, or it is part of the overall package of services offered to the recipient to include a function like anti-spam services. So the email stuff, the only way you can get to the common carriage discussion is basically to ignore most of what we think of as email and focus on only one little piece of it, a critical piece, but still only a piece of the functionality that we describe as email. And so the fact that the justices weren't able to disaggregate the different aspects of email or direct messaging, same thing in my mind, actually really suggested they weren't even understanding the question that they were trying to wrestle with.
I agree. So last question on this. If social media sites are considered common carriers, if that's the way that this goes, is it game over for the social media companies? Does that mean the government can regulate just as they see fit?
Well, there's two different ways that that would be problematic. The first aspect is that by treating them as common carriers, then the government would be allowed, likely, under the Constitution, to be able to require equal treatment of customers and reduce the ability of the services to choose among which customers they want to handle. So in that sense, it would be game over because the trollers and spammers win in that circumstance. They're given equal treatment, even if, in fact, the rest of the community would prefer that they not be allowed on the conversation at all. But the bigger problem is, in order to reach that conclusion, the court would have to conclude that social media services do not qualify as publishers for First Amendment purposes. And by reaching that conclusion, the Supreme Court would open up the door for basically a panoply of any form of regulation under a less restrictive constitutional scrutiny. So it would be game over in two ways. One is that the actual common carrier edicts that would be authorized would be lethal to social media services and their communities. And two is the door would be open for even worse regulation to follow it of unknown nature. But given that the censors are experimenting with all kinds of policy innovations, there is no way to imagine a circumstance where the internet could survive that.
That sounds pretty terrible, and I hope the court gets this right. All right, Vidushi, over to you. So, last week, we tuned in to hear the parties make their arguments before the Supreme Court, and we listened in to how the court reacted to those arguments. But, Vidushi, you weren't just tuning in, you were actually there in the courtroom. What were some of the juicy observations from the hearing that may have been missed by those of us tuned into the live stream? I remember Justice Thomas left the room in the middle of the Gonzalez arguments. Did it happen again here?
Nothing quite that juicy, but as a heads up for anyone who wants to listen in or read the transcript, the arguments ran for over 4.5 hours, which was way longer than normal, and all of the justices were really active in questioning. It's not really something that's so easily picked up on the audio, but I found it really interesting that while some justices focused on separate issues, there wasn't really any discernible friction, and I can't say any visible camps emerged. In fact, there were lots of times where the judges were constantly piggybacking off of one another to make points, and we saw some pretty unlikely pairings and virtually every combination feasible. So I think that might play into what the final ruling might look like, but it certainly wasn't something I expected, and I also didn't expect Justice Thomas to kick us off in both cases with his questioning.
Interesting. So what were your initial impressions when you sort of walked out the door at the end there? What were you thinking after the arguments closed?
Well, one, I was definitely left with the impression that I had going in, which was that these laws were really poorly conceived, and it seemed like there was no pushback on that. Even as we were fleshing out all of these procedural questions, it kept going back to these justices don't understand what these laws are aimed at, and it didn't really seem like the states did either when they were really their feet were held to the fire.
And Professor Goldman, what were your initial impressions? I know you were listening in live.
My initial impressions were that the judges were really overwhelmed by the amount of detail in the laws and all of the possible applications of them. It was too much for them to handle, even in 4.5 hours of oral arguments. They didn't even cover everything that needed to be discussed. And so I felt bad for them in that sense. Like, they were being asked to review more than they could keep straight in their head at any one time. My other impression is that that in order for the internet to remain in its current configuration, the people who like that current configuration, I'm going to call them we for a moment, but I understand that not everyone would feel that way. We need to win them all. We need to win these two cases. We need to win the other cases that are pending with Supreme Court. We need to win the ones that are coming. And there were so many questions that the justices asked that suggested that they want to qualify their statements. They want to provide some caveats to their statements. And it's those qualifications and caveats that could take a win on the votes and turn it into a loss because it's first the next round of censorship innovation. So I came away really feeling overwhelmed by the concern that the opinions are not going to be a clean, succinct, decisive win for the internet as we know it today. And whatever caveats and qualifications are in there, those are going to become really, I think, the loss from this opinion.
So you mentioned that you're feeling overwhelmed by all the different information that was kind of taking place that day. Let's dig into that. So I noticed the court spent the bulk of their time on the content moderation aspects of the Florida and Texas laws. But there's another requirement featured in both laws that the court seemed to just gloss over, having to do with mandatory transparency. Professor Goldman, can you explain the transparency requirements? I know you had written a brief that speaks to this as well.
Most of the attention in the media, in the amicus briefs, and in the oral arguments focused on the content regulation aspects of the laws, how they dictate what content can or cannot be published or must be published on social media. But the laws also contain a variety of what I refer to as compelled editorial transparency. They're designed to provide greater insights into the editorial decision-making of the social media services. We don't have any analog like this anywhere else in the law. Basically, there's no mandatory or compelled editorial transparency for traditional print publishers like newspapers or book publishers. Like, this is just another example of censorship innovation. And the Supreme Court granted as its second question that it accepted the explanations requirement. The requirement in the statute is that when there's an adverse action taken by social media, they have to provide an individualized explanation to the affected user why they made the decision that they made. We have no example about this offline. If the newspaper turns down my op-ed submission or my letter editor, I get no explanation. If I submit a book proposal to a book publisher, I get no explanation. I'm happy to talk more about why I think this is a problem. But for purposes of the discussion and oral arguments, the Supreme Court almost completely ignored it. And I don't know what to make of that. I don't know if that's because it's so clearly a problem that they didn't feel like it warranted airtime. If they think it's so clearly legitimate that they didn't think it warranted any airtime. I did want to correct my co-panelist here. The 11th Circuit struck down the explanations requirement in the Florida law. The 5th Circuit upheld it. So there's a circuit split that the Supreme Court really has to resolve. And they spent no energy giving us any insight into how they're thinking about it. And they didn't seem to think they needed to gather any additional information. So for that purpose, we're just flying blind on this other really significant payload in these very complicated laws.
You know, you said there's no offline analog, but we've seen a lot of commenters point out that mandatory disclosures themselves are a thing. We have the Surgeon General's warning on tobacco and cigarette products. We have, all sorts of, nutritional labels. There's all sorts of mandatory disclosure requirements for other products. What's the difference here?
The difference is that the mandatory disclosures target the editorial decision-making process, which by its nature is the most sacrosanct process in that publishers undertake that the First Amendment is designed to protect. The First Amendment is designed to give the freedom of editorial choice to publishers, and transparency into that becomes a weapon and a sense of obligation that can distort that choice. So when we deal with things like disclosing the amount of sugar in a carbonated beverage, the disclosure is also invasive into the decision whether or not this product is going to be a good contribution to the marketplace. That's often the goal, to regulate via transparency, to force disclosures that businesses don't want to make, and they change their behavior to avoid making those disclosures. But there's no speech that gets changed or speech decisions that get changed by the mandatory disclosure of sugar in carbonated beverages, or frankly, almost all the other mandatory disclosures that we have. There are common regulatory solutions, but they aren't normally applied to editorial decision-making. And that's the policy innovation that's applied here, to say, hey, we're just like, it's just like we're telling Coca-Cola that they had to publish how much sugar is in a bottle of Coke. We're going to tell businesses that make possibly billions of decisions a day that generate individualized explanations for every single one of those decisions that someone doesn't like. Like when you think about it that way, it's like it's apples and oranges. It's a completely different context. And so trying to extend that policy idea of pro-transparency and the normal goods and services being sold in the market to speech publishers is actually like a really big jump to make, not a small one.
Got it. So sugar isn't speech, but publishing about sugar is speech. Excellent. All right, Vidushi, going back over to you. Okay, so as Professor Goldman mentioned, the court just glossed over this entire topic, and I'm super curious from your perspective. You've been reporting on not just these cases, but a ton of other cases, these tech cases in the past. Any thoughts on why the court would just skip over this? Do you think from a procedural perspective, they just sort of had enough to get to the decision they need to get without the discussion on transparency?
I think that the threshold questions on how to view social media companies and content moderation, and then all of the complexities and sidebars that delved into conversations about Section 230 ended up occupying most of their attention and concerns. I will say on the disclosure provisions point, NetChoice did mention that YouTube, for example, would have to increase their disclosure and appeal process essentially 100 times over in order to comply with the Texas law. That was something that did raise some skepticism from the bench on whether this would be as burdensome as it would be in practice and whether platforms would be able to automate this kind of workflow. NetChoice rebuffed this and posited that this would require an absolute response to every takedown and would be far more burdensome than things we're seeing playing out in the EU regarding moderation and explanation. So I think at least in terms of keeping the injunction in place while litigation plays out, understanding the burden that's at play did come out from NetChoice at least.
You know, you mentioned Section 230. Professor Goldman, I'm going to go back to you. It seemed like the justices were really fixated on Section 230, at least a couple of them. Now, I thought this was a First Amendment case. What is the relevance here? It seemed to me that the justices were mostly hung up on the fact that the NetChoice attorneys were making suggestions or assertions that social media companies are publishers per the First Amendment. But how can they be publishers if Section 230 provides them specific special immunities that keep them from being publishers of specific content? The justices were really hung up on that. What say you?
The Supreme Court granted two questions presented, neither of which expressly covered Section 230 at all. And so the idea that some of the justices were trying to increase the importance of Section 230 was just really bizarre, given the questions that were presented, that the Supreme Court said, this is all we're considering in the case. Now, the way they get there is that the laws had exceptions that said, if Section 230 applies, then our law doesn't. So they were trying to find some way to bring in Section 230, but there are so many other ways to analyze the laws. They're so complicated. There's so much richness there. And there's clearly parts that I think Section 230 doesn't reach. Like getting into the Section 30 stuff sidesteps all the other things that the Supreme Court should have been talking about and that were part of the questions that the Supreme Court accepted when they granted certiorari. So Section 230 is a statute, and the First Amendment is a constitutional provision. And I'm sorry to go back to basics, but it's really important. Congress, by statute, cannot amend the Constitution. That's not possible. The only way to amend the Constitution is to follow constitutional amendment procedures, and the Congress on its own doesn't have that power under the Constitution. That's what makes the Constitution so special. It's quite hard to change. So whatever Congress says in Section 230 has nothing to do with how we think about the First Amendment, because Congress, by its own definition, its own authority, doesn't have the ability to define parts of the Constitution. That's not reserved to them unless the Constitution delegated that responsibility. So the fact that Section 230 may say that services are or are not publishers in certain circumstances has nothing to do whether or not those same entities will qualify as publishers, or more importantly, qualify for the rights to free speech and free press under the Constitution. And so, you know, I don't know what to say, except there's certainly a strain within DC of people who just hate Section 230. They cannot wrap their minds around it. And so it's impossible to really have a rational discussion about Section 230 with those folks, because they've just decided it's a bad policy and it cannot be defended. And I felt like maybe some of the justices are reading that kind of content in their spare time.
Well, I personally love Section 230, but I'd be happy to never hear about it again. So with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap. This is our final minute here. What are your predictions? I know folks hate giving predictions about the bench, but let's see what you all are thinking. What are your predictions, and how does this end, both short-term for the case and long-term for the internet? And Vidushi, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, I'd like to call attention to something that the Texas AG said during his arguments, which was, at some point, the First Amendment has to end, which I think really speaks to the goals of these laws. We have these really poorly conceived statutes where not a single justice seemed keen on them. In fact, they were all unabashedly critical about how these laws were constructed. And a really powerful illustration that came out about what an outcome of these laws might look like for platforms due to this ban on viewpoint discrimination is that if a platform wants to host suicide prevention content, they also need to host suicide promotion content. So unsurprisingly, platforms are probably just going to pull any discussion whatsoever on suicide, and this goes for any controversial topic online. So while I think they grappled with the facial challenge, it still has a fair shot of success, especially if the court follows in its own footsteps from APF v. Bonta. But it's also possible the court might decide to issue relatively narrow rulings that make it clear that that the most restrictive parts of these laws are unconstitutional, and they might then let litigation play out to determine what other provisions of these or future laws might be constitutional.
And Professor Goldman, your predictions.
I already mentioned that this is just a snapshot of the tsunami of regulatory initiatives to engage in censorship of the internet. And no matter what happens here, any one of those other cases could blow up the internet. And so, like, we have to win it all, as I mentioned, and I'm bearish that that's going to be possible. I do point out that the Supreme Court has extraordinary power here. What they interpret the scope of the Constitution to be is functionally unamendable. And so anytime they suggest any limit to the protection for social media services, that becomes potentially an immutable fact for anyone who wants to attack social media. And we've seen over and over again that there's a whole lot of political gold for politicians to treat social media or big tech or pick your euphemism as one of the primary ills in our society. And until that changes, we're doomed, because the laws will keep coming. The Supreme Court will eventually not sweat all of them down. And then we have whatever's left after the regulators have devoured the internet.
Well, on that cheery note, we're going to go ahead and wrap. Thank you all so much, Professor Goldman, Vidushi. That was excellent. Thanks for being here.
The Tech Policy Grind podcast was created by fellows at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. It's co-produced by myself, Daniela Guzman-Pena, and Evan Enzer, the editor and co-executive producer. Special thanks to Jess, Vidushi, and Eric for their collaboration and support in bringing this episode to air. I and the other Foundry fellows engage with the Foundry voluntarily and in our personal capacities. The views and opinions expressed on air do not reflect on the organizations we are affiliated with. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tech Policy Grind podcast. Be sure to check out the Foundry on LinkedIn and Twitter. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps out the show. If you're interested in supporting the show, reach out to us at foundrypodcasts@ilpfoundry.us. You can find our email in the show notes as well. See you next time.